So I was just asking for permission from Phompho Anan, Lopos Homchai, and all the senior monks here at the monastery, as well as all of the other monastics, good friends in the Dhamma here, and all of the lay people, to speak on the Dhamma. And Lompo Anan kindly gave me the opportunity to talk to all of you today. So hopefully I can say something that will be of benefit, that you can use to let go of some difficulties or attachments, find a bit more peace and happiness. I think if I can achieve that, then I've done my job well. But it's interesting seeing all of you. And we come together to practice the Dhamma like this, and I think many of you are regular practitioners here, at least online here, that we've been organizing these retreats for, 3 years now? And I think many of you have been coming to most, if not all, of them. So it's been very inspiring to see so many people come and have faith in our teacher, Lompo Anan, have faith in the teachings of the Buddha, willing to come and to practice like this, and willing to use this opportunity and use this technology that we have these days in a very good way, and really in the way that it should be used, you know, used for us to improve our lives and to improve our hearts. And I know that, I think as many monks have mentioned, that many of you have been joining from different time zones and are getting up very early or staying up very late at night. And it's always impressive to see that. So yeah, so that we have this faith in these teachings, and that's really no small thing. And I like to think of at the time of the Buddha that, you know, even a being so great as the Buddha, and that there are so many people who had faith in his teachings, and so many people who realized awakening, who sincerely practiced his teachings. And you get these stories of huge numbers of people going and ordaining, taking on the robes just from hearing one teaching, or awakening just from one teaching. And that's really incredible. But there are also a lot of people who, you know, heard those teachings and weren't interested at all. And a lot of people who, you know, they would have seen the Buddha on arms round and just let him walk past. And so it's up to the faith that we have as well. You know, the faith and the wisdom in our hearts, whether we use these opportunities well. And no matter how great the external conditions may be, that if we don't have faith, if we don't have some wisdom, then they can't do very much to help us. And we just let that opportunity pass us by. So I think with listening to these teachings as we have every single day, know, trying to put them into practice as best we can. And I think reflecting on the teachings and seeing, well, where is it that, what teachings is it that we haven't yet used in our lives? And trying to find out ways that we can pick those up, that we can put those into action. You know, because all the effort that's gone into this, and the great kind of compassion and giving that Lompo Anan has for us to give us these teachings, that they're for the sake of us to pick them up and to use them, to for them to be a benefit for us. And I've often been very deeply impressed and surprised with Lompo Nan and his compassion, that there have been many times that and maybe someone has suggested that we do a retreat like this, or he's come up with the idea himself. And talking to him about it, and he often has so many things that he has on, you know, many duties, a huge number of disciples, pretty much always engaged in something, with helping someone in some way. And even though he has so much to do, when I've asked him that maybe a layperson's invited to do a retreat or something like this, that most of the time he's just, you know, said, okay, let's do it. You know, even if, you know, I've been quite kind of reluctant myself, you know, because of his health or concern for him not having enough time to rest, enough time for himself, that you know, he's you know, responded with, all right, let's do this. And I think that's the kind of compassion that he has for us all, and that he wishes to benefit us, and sees that, you know, these retreats really are of benefit. And I think that all of you attending, that gives him and us all encouragement as well. You know, the times that I've mentioned to him, you know, how many people have been attending and from what countries, that, you know, he has said that this helps him to gain encouragement, you know, to do more of this teaching, to help more of you. But ultimately, it's up to us, you know, to put these teachings into practice. And so what I've noticed with being around him sometimes, you know, translating in a more private way, if there's some people staying at the monastery or some people coming to visit and wanting to talk to him, that there's this constant encouragement for people to just like take the next step, or to extend their boundaries of what it is that they're doing in terms of Dhamma. You know, if it's someone who doesn't yet keep the five precepts consistently, then he gives this encouragement to do that. If it's someone who can keep the five precepts and sometimes recommends to keep the eight precepts, maybe once a week. If they're doing that once a week, then, you know, maybe twice or three times a week. If it's someone who doesn't yet have a consistent meditation practice to do that, or if they do, to they do it for a little bit longer, or to have another period of meditation, you know, maybe meditate in the morning and in the evening as well, or to spend some time in the monastery and do more full practice, spend more time practicing. And so it's this constant encouragement then for us to extend ourselves. Because I think that it's normal for us that we have quite a limited idea of who we are and what we're capable of. And this very fixed, narrow perception of ourselves. And I think that when he sees us, he can see beyond that which we impose upon ourselves. You know, can see to what our actual potential is and what we're actually capable of. And so then, out of that wisdom and out of that kindness, encouraging us to actually more fulfill what we're capable of, what our potential is. And so we're very fortunate to have a teacher who I think can see that and who can do that, give us that encouragement. You know, it's been very useful for me personally, coming to be at this monastery and having a teacher like that who's willing to push me a bit. Because, you know, I too could have these very limited ideas of what I could be capable of. And to have someone who's not willing to kind of play along with that delusion with me and willing to challenge that a bit. And it's very helpful. Because otherwise I think I'd be much more stuck in these old perceptions, old views. I think ultimately what we gain from the practice, like no matter what it is, no matter what aspect it is, whether it's the generosity that we do, whether it's the virtue that we keep, whether it's the meditation that we do, no, what it is, that's goodness that we're creating, and that goodness in turn comes back to us. And that is a source of happiness and a source of ease and peace for us. And so that's what it gives us eventually, right? And the more that we practice, I think for all of you, you know this already, the more that we gain this. I think that's why that we're willing to come and do these retreats like this, because we know that this gives us this happiness, this ease, this peace. But I think we also know that in practicing, it's not always just ease and peace, that we have a lot of difficulty that we have to be with. And so something that Lumpa often tells us and tells the monks is that there can be a lot of difficulty and a lot of suffering, but it's the suffering that has happiness as its reward. It has happiness in the future. Whereas the way of the world, it gives us happiness now, but it has suffering waiting for us in the future. So I think for those beings who have intelligence, they'll be looking for that more long-term happiness. And so in that, it's the fact that this path can be difficult, that it can be arduous, and that we need then to have strength of heart to be able to carry on through. And that if we don't have that, then we'll give up pretty quickly. And so where does that strength of heart come from then? And really, I mean, ultimately it needs to come from our practice as well. But these strengths that the Buddha taught about is the strength of faith, the strength of energy and of mindfulness and samadhi and wisdom, that these are things that we can draw upon, that we really should be drawing upon. And to be able to bring those up and to use them in our practice. And so I think when times can be tough, can be arduous practicing, for myself during this retreat, that unlike most of the previous retreats, that I was actually able to join in most of this myself, that the other people helping out have been helping out a lot, so there hasn't been all that much for me to do this time. So it's been a good opportunity for me as well. But it's been very hot here in this Dharma hall, and wearing the robes of a monk, they're very delightful things to wear, but they also trap heat pretty well. And so sitting with a lot of kind of heat and also various other kinds of pain and sometimes kind of intense pain, that it's, for me, the experience hasn't been all that easy during this retreat. But it's, I think, that ability and that willingness to stay with it, that even though things can be tough, to not run away. And so for me, there are a number of reflections that I like to bring up that can help me with that. And so one is to reflect upon the Krubajans and what they've been through, and the sometimes quite incredible difficulties that they went through in their practice. But they were willing to do that. And Ajahn Chah, he sometimes said to his disciples that I needed to pass over haunted graves and through the jaws of tigers to be able to bring these teachings to you. So you're someone who wouldn't run away from difficulty. He was willing to go into charnel grounds, and perhaps for some of us that doesn't bring up a picture of so much fear, but from what I understand, it was really terrifying. And from what Lumpur Nun has said, the times that he spent in charnel grounds, that he was so scared that at times he thought he was going to go crazy, that the fear was that intense. And he later developed heart problems, and he said that probably the main reason for that was just the fear that he experienced in those charnel grounds, that his heart was pounding so much for so long that he eventually developed heart problems. But he was willing to do that. I think of, there was another teacher, I can't remember who it is now, but he said that he was also terrified of ghosts, and so he went to stay in one of these charnel grounds, and that whenever he got this fear come up that there was a ghost over there, you know, maybe he saw the light of the moon and it was shining through the leaves that were moving and it kind of looked like a ghost, that as soon as he got that fear, that terror come up, he would immediately get up and go straight to the place that he was afraid of, in order to overcome that, to not give in to that. Or just, I think a few days ago, actually after one of these Dhamma talks that Lumpur gave in the morning, he was sitting outside and somehow we got onto the topic of malaria. And he was saying, you know, just how many times he got malaria when he was here. And I asked him whether he ever thought of just packing up and leaving and going setting up a monastery somewhere else, because there are a lot of malaria-carrying mosquitoes here in the early days. And he said, well, of course I thought of that. You know, of course I thought that all of the monks come to staying under my guidance, and every single rains retreat, almost all of us get malaria. And this is just happening year after year after year. And then the lay people who have faith, they're too afraid to come and stay at this monastery because they don't want to get malaria. And some of them who had stayed, they go back home and they find they have malaria back home. So of course I thought of leaving. You know, but still, he stuck it out. And then through that great persistence and that great kindness as well, that we now have this monastery that we can live in today, malaria free, happily. And so for me, it gives me great encouragement then to recollect just the difficulties that these other beings had gone through, but they weren't willing to give in to them. That even though it was really tough, that through their devotion to the Dhamma, that they were willing to stick that out. As Ajahn Chah said, that the Dhamma is on the shore of death. And so he himself was willing to put his life on the line for the Dhamma. And then to reflect upon the very small difficulties that I have to go through, that it really doesn't seem like much in comparison, that if other beings can endure with so much and willingly endure with so much, when they could have got out, they could have run away, but they stayed, and that surely then I can put up with these small, trifling things. So it's useful then, I think, to bring up a point of comparison and something that we can use to give us encouragement. And so whatever that is that works for us. And there's one time I was on Tudong, I was doing walking with my ball and robes and other things in Kanchanaburi province. And I decided to walk along what they call the death railway, which in hindsight was not a very auspicious place to be walking. But but I started off at the bridge that they built during World War II. And the reason they call it the death railway is because in World War II, the Japanese were in a hurry to build this bridge. And so they used slave labor and POWs to build this bridge very, very quickly, build the whole railway very quickly. And they say that between 1 and 200,000 people died building the railway. So on the before the first day, when I was got off the van in Kanchanaburi town, and then to walk to the start of this railway, I had to walk through the whole town. And so I passed by a couple of cemeteries that were for the POWs who had died building this railway. And so in one of them I stopped, and they're these huge cemeteries. I don't know how many graves there are there, but it's a lot. And so I stopped in and was walking through, and I think I was maybe 30 years old, 32 years old at the time. And I noticed that there was pretty much no one who was older than me. That almost everyone who was buried there was in their 20s when they passed away. And so walking then along this railway, and I think the first day was the hottest I've ever been in my life, that there was absolutely no shade. And the railway had these really steep banks on either side, so there's no way to really get off it. Well, I could have gotten off it, but I wouldn't have been able to get back on again. And so walking along this really long stretch, just in the sun for many hours, and sweating more than I'd ever sweated before in my life, naturally the mind would start to complain a little bit, you know, about the discomfort, about the physical pain. But as soon as I'd start doing that, I'd tell myself, well, at least I'm not being beaten to death, you know, like many of the other people who had been on this railway. You know, I've actually got it quite easy compared to all of these other people who, you know, died very young. So I think, you know, whether we find things easy or difficult, whether it's comfortable or uncomfortable, you know, a lot of that depends upon what we compare it to. If we're comparing ourselves to some ideal life that we may have in our mind, then, you know, just small discomforts can be very disconcerting. I think if we compare ourselves to something else, then we're able to go through things, because we can see how other people have gone through much more difficult things. You know, for us, that we're doing this for the Dhamma. You know, this is really the greatest and most beneficial endeavor that anyone could engage on. And so surely then we should be willing to bring up effort and to be persisting through difficulties. And so for whatever it is that we can bring up to remind ourselves that other beings have gone through far worse, the times have been far more difficult, maybe we can even compare it to things that we've experienced in our own lives. And that's one of the benefits that Lampo Nan has said about maybe taking on extra practices at some times. You know, there are some people, monastics, and also I think a number of the lay people here who have done the practice of staying up all night and meditating all night. And there's many benefits that can come from that, but one of those is that, you know, maybe we're meditating on another night and it's getting kind of late, and then the thought comes up, okay, well, I should stop now because you know, I need to go to bed. It's my bedtime already. But then if we can bring up that memory of how we had spent the whole night meditating on other nights, then we can think to ourselves, okay, well, it's fine. You know, I can carry on going for a bit more. Maybe if I get a little bit less sleep than what I'm used to, then that's okay. Because I've done something which is more difficult than this before. And so we can gain encouragement from that. And so bringing up faith, you know, faith in our teacher. So something that I like to reflect upon is that, you know, through the great wisdom, the great compassion that the Buddha had, he gave these teachings to us. And that if it wasn't possible for us to carry out these teachings and to realize them, then he wouldn't have done it. Because what's the point in teaching something to someone who just isn't capable of doing that thing? And so the Buddha then taught us, out of his wisdom and compassion, also have these two, I believe, to be awakened beings who are doing the same, teaching us out of their wisdom and compassion. And one of the reasons that they're teaching these things to us is because we can do them. These are things that we can put into effect in our lives. So I think the beliefs that we have are very important things. And I've noticed for myself that the beliefs I have can sometimes be very subtle and very, I mean, it's almost like this white noise or this low hum that, because it's there all the time, I just don't really see it. You know, sometimes the beliefs that we have, that they can be with us, you know, from a very young age. And so we just don't question them, that that's, for us, just how things are. And I think it's really useful to look at those and to question them. And so what beliefs do you hold about yourself? What beliefs do you have about the Dhamma? What beliefs do you have about what you're capable of achieving? You know, do we hold these beliefs of, well, I can't really do this. Like, I'm not really a good practitioner. I can't meditate very well. You know, I know that these are beliefs that I've definitely have and that I've had before and that I can fall back into as well. Because if we really cling to these beliefs, then they are true. And they're true because we believe them. And that if we truly believe that we can't meditate, well, then we can't really meditate. You know, if we truly believe that we're not able to do it, well, then that belief becomes true and we're not really able to do it. And so I think it's very helpful then to question those, to bring those up. And is this actually true? And where did I get this belief from? You know, this belief that, well, maybe I can't really attain to the Dhamma, I can't do it. That, where did that belief come from? And is that actually accurate? Like, is that belief in line with the teachings of the awakened beings? Is that belief in line with the teachings of the Buddha? And if it's not, then it's something that we really, really should be questioning, that we should thoroughly examine and see, is that actually true? And is it helping us? And if we put that belief down, then what happens? I think if we're holding on to something, I mean, whatever it is, but a belief, for example, that if we put it down and what we experience is a sense of ease, a sense of energy, enthusiasm, brightness of mind, then what that shows us quite clearly is that belief really isn't serving us. It's not helping us, but it's something that's pulling us back, that's hindering our progress. So I think then, yeah, to ask, what beliefs do I hold about myself, about the Dhamma, my ability to practice the Dhamma? Are these things actually true? Are they in line with reality? Do I actually know this? And if it's not helpful, if it's not what the Buddha taught, if it's not what our teacher teaches, then suggest to try putting that down, try challenging it, and try going against it. And if we do that, then then we can start gaining beliefs which are actually useful for us and which help to propel us further along the path. I think for myself and for many people that I've talked to, and also many people have come to talk to Longpo Anan, that I think these days one of the things that can really trip us up and cause us great difficulties is the idealism that we can hold to. That combined with being very critical, especially critical of ourselves. And kind of having this like comparing mind and a fault-finding mind. And then when all of those are put together, then what that can produce then is these ideals of who we should be, which in and of themselves, they're not bad things, but it's how we hold that that's important. And that we come to the practice, and I think it's easy to gain this view of who we think we should be, that suddenly now I am practicing Buddhism, I consider myself a Buddhist, a Dharma practitioner, and so I should never get angry. I should always be in a state of perfect peace and equanimity. Nothing should be able to throw me off. And I shouldn't be greedy. And that if any of these things come up, then it's wrong. And so we have that idealistic view of ourselves. And then we look at our actual experience and we look at that with a fault-finding mind and see all the things that are wrong with our experience, and then compare that to this idealistic view that we have. And then from that, I can feel quite dejected and even averse towards oneself. And for myself, pretty much the first time I learned to meditate, like I'd done a little bit of meditation before, this kind of Hindu style of meditation, but came to Thailand the first time when I was 18, and I just bumped kind of randomly into this Peace Corps volunteer who told me that he had lived like a monk for a week. And I thought, that sounds great, I want to do that. So he wrote down the address of the monastery for me. And then I was helping to teach in the school at the time, and so I gave it to one of the teachers, and she happened to know of the monastery. And so she helped to phone up, and they said that they had a retreat from the 1st to the 10th of every month. And I had no idea what a retreat was, but I decided I'd show up. So I went along and they showed me around the place and they were explaining the rules. I really didn't know what I was getting myself into. And they showed me the room, and it was, I mean, it looked like a prison cell. It's like this concrete box with iron windows and a concrete bed and a wooden pillar. And then they were explaining that, you know, you don't eat after midday. I really like having dinner, so that didn't sound very nice. And then, you know, that there's no talking at all in many hours of meditation. But I thought to myself, okay, I'll just do this. And as long as it's not like weird and creepy and it long doesn't turn out to be some kind of fanatical cult, I'll stay and see what it's like. And so I stayed and did the retreat. And having not had much experience with meditation, sitting on the ground, cross-legged for many hours was really, really painful. And then I'd look up and I'd look at everyone else. There were many other people on the retreat. I think there was about 80 to 100 people. And look around and everyone just looks so serene and calm and at ease. And I close my eyes again and just be in this intense pain. And then as the days went on, as the second day, the third day, that I got kind of some more clarity over my mind. And before I started that retreat, I really thought I was a good person, a nice person. But then after looking at my mind for 3 days, and I somehow pretty much managed to develop aversion towards every single person on the retreat within 3 days. And there was this anger and sometimes hatred towards many of the people. And sometimes for the most stupid reasons. This one guy, I remember, just the way he walked, I really didn't like that. And then another person, we did yoga in the morning, and it's like the way that he was doing yoga posture just really annoyed me. And then someone else, when we did like the corpse pose at the end of yoga, that he would start snoring after a few seconds, and so I started hating him for that. And so after 3 days, I really thought that, so looking at my mind and really got this feeling that this must be the most terrible mind on the planet. Like, I'm pretty sure that there's no being worse than this. And that wasn't a pleasant thing to be with. You know, being someone who really thought that they were like nice and kind and pleasant. But fortunately, as the days went on, that the mind started to get a bit more peaceful, and I had some nice peaceful meditation experiences, and then, you know, things calmed down. They also taught us metta meditation, which was very helpful. So I managed to forgive almost everyone for walking strangely and such things by the end of the retreat. But I think that, you know, when we look into our minds, what we see oftentimes, it cannot be very pleasant. And I think when the mindfulness starts getting a bit stronger, then we can start to see how it is that the defilements are working in our minds. And that can be quite a sobering insight. And I imagine everyone here has had that, at least to some degree. You know, start carry on meditating and then just suddenly seeing how the mind is, you know, doing something which is bringing a lot of pain, which is like very unskillful activity. And that can really go against this ideal version that we have of ourselves as a Buddhist practitioner. It's just, you know, being love and light all the time. And so with that going against this ideal version that we have of ourselves, that then it can be aversion coming up. And it's aversion towards ourselves. I shouldn't be like this. It's wrong for me to be like this. It's wrong for me to experience this. This is bad. And I'm bad. And so that's one way of relating to it. And for myself and many people I've talked to, it seems to be something, this trap that many people can get into. But really what that is, it's just defilement overlaying defilement, that we see this unskillful activity in the mind and then the mind responds to it with more unskillful activity. And that's really not helpful. It just makes the situation worse. So I think a much wiser relationship to this is to actually feel a sense of gratitude and joy whenever we see that, and whenever it is that we find anything new out about our mind, but I think especially the things which are unskillful and which are painful. That even though that might go against our view of who we think that we should be, that insight is actually a really important, significant insight. Because we can think about just how long it is that habit has been present within our minds. And we've had absolutely no idea what was going on. You know, as the Buddha taught, that we've been born for countless lifetimes, you know, that he himself looked through his previous lives and couldn't find a beginning. And that through that process, we've been deluded the entire time. And that we've had these unskillful activities going on inside our minds for such an incredibly long time. But now, having had this awareness and this insight that, like, I'm aware of what's happening, that I've seen this, and that seeing, it's really important. Because if we don't see that, if we allow ourselves to just carry on being ignorant, then that thing controls us. It's always there working inside our minds, causing us pain. It's just we don't see what's going on. And that we feel that pain, we experience the pain, but we don't know why it's happening. And then we can start, you know, blaming all different kinds of things just because we don't know what's going on. So we try to find a cause for our suffering, and we mostly look outside of ourselves and start blaming all kinds of things outside of ourselves. But really it's happening within us. It's just we don't see what's happening. So by seeing, by having that kind of an insight into any unskillful or painful activity of the mind, that we start realizing where that pain is coming from. And within that realization, it is the freedom from that pain. That within that realization, then, that we can now do something about it. And we can have the trust, can have the encouragement and the faith that with practicing the teachings of the Buddha, with us being a disciple of a Krubajan, of an awakened being, that we do have the means and the ability to be able to overcome this and to get through it. And it may take a bit of time. Sometimes it can just be a short amount of time, but sometimes it can be a number of years. But if we stick with it, then we will get through it. So then I think when we experience this, then, when we see something come up, maybe a way that we're getting angry about something, a way we're getting jealous about something, or whatever it is, that we can be very happy that we've seen that. It can be this gratitude that I've seen this now, and now within this seeing, then I have the chance to work through this and to put this down. And then as we go along, then steadily we put it down, we put it down, we experience the freedom from that pain, we experience this extra lightness of mind, this happiness of mind. I think it really requires that, though, in our Dharma practice, to be willing to look in to the, perhaps, the more ugly side of the mind or the ways that it's doing things which are not really working for us, that aren't working in line with the Dhamma, and be willing to be there with it, to not run away from it. But what's also really important is to not just become averse towards it. And again, from my own experience and from conversations I've had with many people, I think that's something that people these days can really get into. You know, I get the feeling that in previous times, people were much more accepting of themselves and of flaws within themselves, but these days it doesn't really seem to be that way. And so then it can be the case that, say, anger comes up in the mind, and we get really flustered by that, and we try to just get rid of it as quickly as possible. And if that's coming from a place of aversion, it's not really going to work. Because again, we're just overlaying defilement with defilement. That anger's come up, and then we're getting angry at the anger, or we're getting angry at ourselves for experiencing anger. And if it's like that, then we can't really do very much. And it's like this one object that's come up, and then the mind is then overlaying that, so with something else, with this barrier. And until we remove that barrier, then we can't actually get at that original thing. So I found it really helpful then, I mean, with everything, but especially with unskillful qualities, that when they arise, to just check what my relationship to this is. And as Lumpur Anan, Lumpur Cha very frequently encouraged, you know, this not getting into liking, not getting into disliking, that if we're acting through either of those tendencies, either of those delusions, then that's not the path. That's not the path to freedom. That's not what's going to lead us to the end of suffering. So then if an unskillful quality comes up, well, am I averse to this? And am I averse to myself for experiencing this? And if there is that aversion, then we need to clear that out first before we can get at the actual thing. And so I think bringing up the sense of acceptance. And acceptance here, it doesn't mean that we don't do anything, that we just leave it as it is. But what it means is bringing that mind, the mind back to that state of centeredness, to being in the middle, to not going off into liking, not going off into disliking, but able to be with something for what it is, and just calmly stay with it and experiencing it for how it is. And if it's hard to do that, then you can bring up metta and spread loving kindness towards even this thing, this object, towards the anger, spread loving kindness towards ourselves. You know, bring up this acceptance that it's just normal. It's normal for us as practitioners that, I mean, really what that means, being a practitioner, is that we're not perfect yet. And that's why we're practitioners, right? That's why we need to practice. That if we were already perfect, then there would be no need. And so it's this acknowledgement that there are things within us that need to change, and that that's okay. You know, that it's just normal for beings born into this world that we have a certain degree of delusion, have a certain degree of greed and hatred and defilement. And that's just standard, that's how it is for all the beings who are born into this world. You know, and that's all right, and I think the reason that that's all right is because we're doing something about it, that we're not just complacent, we're not just following along with it, going along with the flow of those unskillful qualities, as most people are, but we're doing something about it. But that something that we're doing, it doesn't happen instantly, that it takes time for that to happen. And so we just need to bring up that acknowledgement and that acceptance that this is going to take time. And in the time that I'm practicing, that I'm going to experience many of these things. You know, there's going to be anger come up, and sometimes it can be really, really intense anger. And that also sometimes when we're really practicing, we're going against these defilements, and the defilements, they're not happy with that. They don't like being opposed. That they're used to just getting their way all the time. And so when we start going against them, they can really put up a fight. And I think how many people understand that is that I'm practicing wrong. You know, that I sit down and maybe I'm experiencing sometimes more intense anger than I had before. But that's not necessarily the case. But however it is, that, you know, having these minds that are still deluded, we're going to be experiencing these things. And so just accept that for now. And having accepted that, you know, being in a state of equanimity, having kindness towards ourselves, then we can go about doing something about it. And we can bring up that reflection on death, you know, that I will die soon, and so what's the point? And giving rise to this. And they were all in the same boat. This other person's also going to have to die soon. And so why be angry with them? We start getting curious about it as well. I find that really useful, you know, to kind of oppose that tendency of aversion towards these unskillful qualities, to start getting curious about them, start really wanting to know how they function, how they work. You know, what is it that they're doing? How do they operate? And so with this anger, I find it really interesting, like looking at that and seeing how it works. And then seeing how, really, when I'm angry, I'm just angry at my own mind. That I'm not angry at anything else. That even perhaps someone has said something to me that I don't like, and maybe go sit in meditation. And then there's that memory of that thing that they said that comes up. And then I get angry at that. But it's my mind that's producing that memory. And then there's this idea of that person is an image that the mind creates. There's this story that the mind tells about who this person is. But that image is something that my mind creates. That story is something that my mind creates. And so the whole time I'm just angry with my own mind and the creations of my mind, that it's not getting angry at someone else. And so eventually the question arises, well, maybe I should just stop doing this. Maybe it'd be better to not give rise to these creations, that they're really not helping me. Maybe some new creations would be better, and bringing up thoughts of kindness, thoughts of compassion. You know, kindness towards oneself first, because feeling that anger, it's really not pleasant. It's a very hot, uncomfortable feeling in the mind. So I think this is all a matter of learning then how to teach ourselves, how to be, in a way, good parents towards ourselves. And I've never been a parent in this life, so I don't know exactly what that's like, but I did teach little children for a while, so I have a little bit of experience, but at least in my mind, it's a useful way of conceptualizing what the practice is. It's like being a good parent for the mind. You know, so one thing that we have to be on top of what's happening, right? That if the parent just allows the child to go off and they're not aware of what the child's doing, then that's very dangerous. And so with our minds, we have all of these, I mean, all this delusion, but all these habits that aren't helpful for us. And if we just allow the mind to go off, it's going to go off following those habits, and it's going to get itself into a lot of pain. And I think we've all experienced that. And I think especially if we reflect upon the period that we had before we started practicing, we know what that was like. The mind just running here and there uncontrollably without anyone looking after it, getting itself into all kinds of pain, all kinds of problems. And so one aspect of being a good parent for our minds is that we are actually there with them, that we're aware of what's happening. And so we try to have that mindfulness over them constantly. And I see what's going on. And then also being a good parent. As Lomporanan mentioned in one of the answers to one of the questions a few nights ago, that it requires both that aspect of encouragement and also an aspect of discipline as well. And both of those are really important. Because if we're too heavy on one side, then it goes off. And I think your parents can know that as well. You know, that if just praising a child and allowing the child to do whatever they want, then, you know, that can go off in a bad way. But if the parent's also too hard on the child and criticizing them too much, you know, blaming them too much, shouting them too much, that also goes off in another way. So we need to know how to get a balance of that. You know, when it is to lift up the mind, when it is to encourage ourselves, to give ourselves some praise, and when it is to start reining the mind in. I think especially if it's going off, in a direction that's really painful for it, then we do whatever we can to stop it from going there. And even sometimes that requires some force. And if that's coming from compassion and from this mindfulness and wisdom, then that's fine. You know, if that's what it requires. And so there's a teaching of the Buddha that I'd like to reflect upon. It's one of my favorite teachings because it's quite simple. Like it phrases the whole path of practice in this simple way. That he was teaching his son, Rahula, and they say that Rahula was 7 years old at the time of this teaching. And then he asked Rahula what a mirror is for. And Rahula said, well, it's to reflect. And the Buddha said, right, and so we need to be always reflecting upon ourselves, to be reflecting upon our acts of our body, our speech, and our mind. And so he said, if you see that you want to do an act of the body that is going to bring suffering for yourself, to others, or to both, that's an unskillful act with painful results, then you should not do that. And if it's something which is going to give, or not going to give painful results, and that's something that you can do. And then when we are currently acting, when you are currently acting, that if you see this action that you're engaged in, that if that is an action which is bringing about painful results to yourself, to others, to both, that's unskillful, that has painful results, then you should stop doing that. But if not, then you can carry on. And then if you reflect upon an action that you have done, and you see that that action brought pain to yourself, to others, to both, then you should, you know, feel like, I never want to do that action again, and make this determination to not do it. We also recommend to find out a trusted spiritual companion or a teacher and to tell them about that action as well. And so the same was for speech too, and the same for actions of mind. That if we're about to engage in an action of mind and you realize that this is going to bring painful results, then you should not do that. If you're currently engaged in an action of mind, you realize this is bringing about painful results, then you should stop. And if you've engaged in an action of mind that's brought about painful results, then you should feel that this was not appropriate for me to have done. This is something that is definitely not worthy of doing, and to resolve to not do that again. So I found for myself that teaching was really useful. That sometimes there can be these habits of the mind which can be so strong. And we know that they're painful, but for whatever means, we convince ourselves that it's okay to do it, or that we should be doing it. Remember, that was, for myself, as long as I can remember really, that I have this habit of coming down really hard on myself if I made any mistake, that the mind would really start beating itself up quite thoroughly and severely. And it had its own reasoning, its own logic to it. It would feel like, well, if I do this, then I'll improve. If I do this, I won't make the same mistake again. I'll be a better person. But I could also see just how incredibly painful that habit of mind was. At the same time, it was so strong that it was really hard to go against, and I'd end up by just giving into it. And I remember this one time, I think it was a relatively new monk, Lumpa had kindly given me the chance to go to one of the secluded huts up the hill of this monastery, and spending a lot of time meditating, and I could see my mind starting to get itself into this rut again of self-criticism and beating itself up. And it was coming up really strong, and I knew where it was going. You know, this is going to be probably about a week of a lot of pain. And fortunately, I just listened to a recording of the sutta that I just mentioned. And so I could feel the mind start to get into this activity which was going to cause pain, which was very unskillful. And on the one hand, there was that great habit energy and that feeling of like, this is the right thing to do. But then bringing up the teaching of the Buddha and recollecting him saying, this is absolutely unfit for you to do. That if you know this is going to cause pain, this is absolutely unfit for you to do. That there were these two things which were kind of at battle within my mind. That on the one hand, there was this really strong energy pulling me into that habit again. And then on the other hand, there was this recollection of the teaching of the Buddha. And this feeling that I know that the Buddha wouldn't want this for me. That he said that I shouldn't do this. And I really don't want to oppose the teachings of the Buddha. And so tried to pull the mind out of this habit. And this was going on for a long time. And I found the thing that really drained my energy was this thought that would come up of, this is hopeless, that I've given into this every single time. I'm not going to be able to do it again. I can't do this. But then when that would come up, then bring up this recollection of the teaching, this Buddha saying, this is absolutely unfit for you to do. And then that giving me energy to pull my mind away from it. And it really took a lot of energy, bringing up a lot of energy, and pulling my mind away from this state. But I think after 2 or 3 hours, was able to do that, and this habit then started fading away. And in the place of that habit, there was this joy that came up that, you know, I finally did it. I was able to do that. And if I can do it this time, I can definitely do it again. So I tell this story because I think all of us have unskillful mental habits that we can get ourselves into a rut with. We get stuck in, and they can start spiraling us downwards. We start getting into them, the energy of the mind starts getting lower, it starts getting dark, and then we get into it even more. And it can just go down and down and down. And I think it's really useful then to bring up that for whatever it is, whatever habit that is, if it's a habit of anger, a habit of aversion, whether that's towards other people, towards ourselves, a habit of maybe guilt over things in the past, worry over things in the future, whatever it is, and if we see that it's an unskillful habit that the mind is about to engage in, that to bring up that kind of image of the Buddha or that teaching of the Buddha, that this is absolutely unfit for you to do, and then can help us to pull the mind out of that. And even though we can start falling into it again, then we pull it out again and just do that how many of a times it takes for it to work. Because having followed these habits for a long, long time now, it's no easy thing to put them down and to go against them. But it is something that we're capable of doing. So I feel like I've talked in English for a long time now. Yeah, I hope something that I said was helpful and useful to you. And again, my anumodana, I do rejoice in the practice that all of you are doing. I think most of you very consistently, you know, this faith, this energy. And so may this lead you to very good results of peace and happiness and quickly lead to the end of suffering.